I was conveyed upstairs by two servants, Bessie and Miss Abbott. "What we tell you is for your good," said Bessie, in no harsh voice. "You should try to be useful and pleasant. Then, perhaps, you would have a home here. But if you become passionate and rude, Missus will send you away, I'm sure."
"Besides," said Miss Abbott, "God will punish her. He might strike her dead in the midst of her tantrums, and then where would she go? Come, Bessie, we will leave her. I wouldn't have her heart for anything. Say your prayers, Miss Eyre, when you're by yourself, for if you don't repent, something bad might be permitted to come down the chimney and fetch you away." They went, shutting the door and locking it behind them.
The Red Room was a square chamber, very seldom slept in. I might say never, indeed, unless when a chance influx of visitors at Gateshead Hall rendered it necessary to turn to account all the accommodation it contained. Yet it was one of the largest and stateliest chambers in the mansion. A bed, supported on massive pillars of mahogany, hung with curtains of deep red damask, stood out like a tabernacle in the centre. The two large windows, with their blinds always drawn down, were half shrouded in festoons and folds of similar drapery. The carpet was red. The table at the foot of the bed was covered with a crimson cloth. The walls were a soft fawn colour, with a blush of pink in it. The wardrobe, the toilet table, the chairs were of darkly polished old mahogany. Out of these deep surrounding shades rose high and glared white the piled-up mattresses and pillows of the bed, spread with a snowy Marseille counterpane. Scarcely less prominent was an ample cushioned easy chair near the head of the bed, also white, with a footstool before it, and looking, as I thought, like a pale throne. Mr. Reed had been dead 9 years. It was in this chamber he breathed his last. Here he lay in state. Hence his coffin was borne by the undertaker's men, and since that day a sense of dreary consecration had guarded it from frequent intrusion. Superstition was with me at that moment. But it was not yet her hour for complete victory. My blood was still warm. The mood of the revolted slave was still bracing me with its bitter vigour. I had to stem a rapid rush of retrospective thought before I quailed to the dismal present. My head still ached and bled with a blow and fall I had received. No one had reproved John for wantonly striking me. And because I had turned against him to avert further irrational violence, I was loaded with general opprobrium. The next thing I remember is waking up with a feeling as if I had had a frightful nightmare and seeing before me a terrible red glare crossed with thick black bars. I heard voices too, speaking with a hollow sound and as if muffled by a rush of wind or water. Agitation, uncertainty and an all-predominating sense of terror confused my faculties. Ere long, I became aware that someone was handling me, lifting me up and supporting me in a sitting posture, and that more tenderly than I had ever been raised or upheld before. I rested my head against a pillow or an arm and felt easy. I felt an inexpressible relief, a soothing conviction of protection and security, when I knew that there was a stranger in the room. An individual not belonging to Gateshead and not related to Mrs. Reed. Turning from Bessie, though her presence was far less obnoxious to me than that of Abbott, for instance, would have been, I scrutinised the face of the gentleman. I knew him. It was Mr. Lloyd, an apothecary,